Okay. We're in business. Joseph will be happy. So this week I looked again at how it all holds together and thought I would try, I'm not sure it'll work, to do 10 of these because it creates a sort of full one idea, starting at number 53, where he says, "For the unified mind in accord with the way, all self-centered striving ceases." For the unified mind in accord with the way, all self-centered striving ceases. The next one is, doubts and irresolutions vanish, and life in true faith is possible. Doubts and irresolutions vanish, and life in true faith is possible. With a single stroke, we are freed from bondage. Nothing clings to us, and we hold to nothing. All is empty, clear, self-illuminating, with no exertion of the mind's power. Here, thought, feeling, knowledge, and imagination are of no value. In this world of suchness, there is neither self nor other than self. To come directly into harmony with this reality, just simply say when doubt arises, not to. In this not to, nothing is separate, nothing is excluded. No matter when or where, enlightenment means entering this truth. And this truth is beyond extension or diminution in time or space. In it, a single thought is 10,000 years. So a unified mind, the unified mind in accord with the way, all self-centered striving ceases. So the question is, what is a unified mind and how can we get one? But actually in our practice, our whole effort is to align ourselves. In terms of posture, we talk about an alignment. And as we find ourselves sitting in alignment with the universe, I sometimes think, as we breathe, we begin to feel how it all is fitting together with this body here, right here. It's our alignment is also how we practice the precepts, how we are able to live in accord with the world without making a mess, too much of a mess, at least determining not to make a mess, even though we do, and to exercising our inherent wisdom, being willing to call it up, being willing not to run on automatic. So it's self-centered striving is the striving that splits itself into two or more. And one way that helped me understand this was when I had surgery, a major surgery many years ago, and I came in back to from the surgery and was so resistant to what had happened. I did not like it. I did not want to be there. I didn't want it to have happened. And there were two of me, the one that it had happened to, that wasn't feeling well at all, And the one that was so upset and so determined to somehow change it. And then I realized, oh, and I wrapped my arms around myself and I just rocked myself. I thought, oh, poor thing, poor thing. Because that's what the situation was. That's how it was. So that's what this means. It's not some fancy esoteric kind of state of mind. It's being willing to be with the loneliness and the pain and the sadness and the happiness and joy as they come rolling through our life and unfolding as we unfold. That's a unified mind. So we don't have to keep trying all the time. We're already there. Doubts and irresolutions vanish, and life in true faith is possible. This whole thing is called trust in mind. So faith in life itself, faith in things just as they are, that we're being held and carried just as we hold and carry, that the whole thing is happening not only to us, which is how it feels, but through us and as us. And once we realize that, we don't have to be so self-conscious about what's happening to us. The why is it happening to me? There's no answer to that question. What's happening happens. And as he says, there's no particular I to doubt, to be unhappy about. Each I is its own self, and we're often reverting back to another I and trying to keep it going, but what's happening to this I is what's happening, not to the one that was just before. That's one of the real mysteries of our life, and one that once we allow the truth of it, things become a little easier. If we keep reverting back and trying to bring up an old thing into the present, rather than just being trying to see clearly what the present is, we save a lot of time and effort. With a single stroke, we are freed from bondage. Nothing clings to us, and we hold to nothing. So now he's getting eloquent about emptiness and the practice of shunyata. He leans way far into the emptiness side in this part of it. And so this is about freeing ourselves from our clinging, freeing ourselves from trying to hold tight to some idea about our life and ourself. If we, as Musang says, we can be open-handed in life rather than like this always. It's what Uchiyama Roshi said too, opening the hand of thought. Because the clinging is just ideas that we have. Very tight-fisted ideas. I want it to be this way. I don't want it to be this way. And all the while, this way is this way. All is empty, clear, self-illuminating, with no exertion of the mind's power. And this, in terms of Zazen, is what we discover so many times. We come to sit, and the mind's power is what brings us to sit. We have an idea of what the sitting is going to be. And then we sit down and begin to realize how little control we have over what's happening. And on a long sit of many days, perhaps, the mind begins to lose its determination to run the show. And it creates peaceful moments when it allows the show to run itself. Of course, we need the side that runs the show, that pretends to run the show. But that's just one side, and the other side is to totally relinquish that ambition, especially in Zazen, and see what's happening, and see what happens. But in life itself, also. Thought, feeling, knowledge, and imagination are of no value. So it's from this side, from the emptiness side, you can see how all of the things that we value so much, our imagination, our thinking, all of our passions are so ephemeral. None of them is real in the sense of being fixed and salvageable in any kind of way. We can't pack them up in a box and keep them in the closet. We can't bring them out and show them to our friends. It's all passing through. It's all transparent and moving. So there's nothing to hold on to in that sense. If you think there should be, then you can get a little dizzy. But there isn't any should be about it. It's just as it is. In this world of suchness, there is neither self nor other than self. Can I skip one? No. So, in the space of luminosity, Musong calls it, the space of light, which is what prajna means, wisdom, the place of luminosity, there's no self-consciousness of self. I said last week, we don't erase the self because there's no self to get rid of. We don't have to drop the ego, we can just see through the pretension of the self that tries to be something special and different from everybody else. Neither self nor other than self in this world of suchness. On Saturday evening, Wendy and I sat in this very room and were part of the audience of a meeting of a Quaker, Jewish rabbi, a Muslim woman, all wrapped up beautifully, and the teacher across the street.
Grace Ellen O'Brien.
Yes, Grace O'Brien. Who gave each a talk about the need for, in their case, religious understanding of diversity in religions, so that they could bring out the message into the world that Muslims are okay to Christians, and that Quakers are okay to yogis, and find ways of introducing each other to the different places and different people. So they said the thing that's common for all of them is food. And just go to the mosque and eat with everybody and get to know them that way and invite them to come and, in our case, I guess, to sit with us. So we don't proselytize in that way. But as a social kind of aspect of those religious practices, it was a recognition of this self-other that has no duality in it. And I've always thought that Buddhism came to the democracy side of things because that's our basic premise, that all beings are Buddha nature. And in a way, that's what our constitution says also. All beings, not just some special ones. Nobody's special. However, that makes everybody special, including oneself. In this world of suchness, and the world of suchness sounds very special and far off. And I think this gets into that sort of passionate exposition of emptiness that makes it sound like something. But actually, the world of suchness is this world. You can't say that world, this world. It is this world. To come directly into harmony with this reality, just simply say when doubt arises, not to. I was taught it as saying not one, not two. If you say one, you immediately have an idea about what it is. And then it's already two. And if you say not two, there's no place to stand except right in the middle. Not two brings us into harmony with the reality of the world of suchness as neither self nor other than self. So nothing is being wiped out. But everything is being illuminated. In this not two, nothing is separate and nothing is excluded. And that's a radical thought, actually. In terms of social values and structures. And we have to say, what about Hitler? What about Al-Qaeda? What about those mean people down the street? The truth is, it's just one great not-to-ness. He says, no matter when or where, enlightenment means entering this truth. The truth that nothing is separate and nothing is excluded. That was Buddha's original teaching. When he was enlightened, he said, all beings are enlightened with me. The mind opens, and even though we can't see it, if we try to see it with our thinking mind, we can feel it with our all of our senses. In the Vipassana practice, the metta practice of starting with loving kindness with the self, and then loving those we love anyway, and then the ones that we don't know, and the ones that we don't like at all, and the ones we hate, and then we just expand it into all beings. And if you do that practice, you find that you really, it's in you already. When I first heard about this practice, I was amazed because it had happened to me during Sesshin. I'd never heard of it. It just happened. I just started feeling my way through all the people in the world that I knew and didn't know, and my heart just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think somebody 1,000 years ago had that experience and said, I'll teach everybody. Let's call it metta. And then created this whole system. It's in us. And this truth is beyond extension or diminution in time or space. So that brings us right back to the whole question of time and space, about what time means for us. Is it a long line that we travel along? It is, in the way that we think it. We think time. But we experience time as being, as each moment as we live and breathe. And that's when he says, in it a single thought is 10,000 years. Because where we are is where we have come from, and also where we're going. Sometimes in Sesshin, I have this sense of the ancestors who brought this Dharma to us is still participating in some way with our sitting. And that all the years that have gone into our life from those who gave us this life in the first place, going back thousands and thousands of years, and all the ones that are to come, it's a part of us. And so our practice actually, I was taught, affects the past and the future. You know, the more devoted to practice, or the more clear we are, that it actually affects the past and the future. I can see it in families, when families begin to get involved with practice and begin to reconnect with parents and grandparents in new ways. And many times there are healings that happen just because in practice we become more open and less anxious about ourself and begin to realize our connections in different ways. And certainly in that sense it's true. And who knows, in a more mysterious way, going back to deeper in the past. A single thought is 10,000 years. So that's all. And there's time for a little discussion. Sorry it took so long with the machine. Questions? Julian?
It's maybe a little bit fuzzy, but I've been thinking about like ideologies and, I mean, evaluating your life, like, in the, I don't know, trying to see some kind of, I mean, is it a waste of time to try and figure out certain consequences in the larger scheme of things of your life?
No, it's real important. Really important. Our ideology is based on the precepts. And the precepts are based on doing no harm to others. So that's pretty simple, but it's pretty profound, actually. And of course, sometimes we do have to do harm just because it's a lesser harm than another harm that would be a greater harm. There's some very painful decisions that we have to make sometimes because it's not so simple. But yeah, we you know, the three pure precepts, embracing and sustaining right conduct, which embracing and sustaining every good and embracing and sustaining all beings. And then that's followed by the 10 precepts, the prohibitory precepts of not killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, drugs and alcohol, praise and blame, past dwelling on past mistakes, hoarding materials and teachings, being angry, and abusing the three treasures. So That's always seemed to me like plenty of guidelines.
In terms of those guidelines in the way the world, I don't know, I mean, the consumeristic aspect.
Yes.
Of the, and it's not always so apparent that it's that way, or like that.
Yeah.
That you've somehow been, I don't know, suckered into something, or, you know, something like that.
Yeah. The thing to remember is that there are so many causes and conditions that go into every single situation. So many that we can never really completely figure it out. And our karmic responsibility is to do what's best for the situation as we understand it and be open to changing our mind if it looks like we're making a mistake. To stay open and flexible, but to take responsibility for the place where you are now. It's not easy. Life is not easy. And sometimes it's hell. Well, it's 8:00.